What's up, my friends? Kyle Tierman here, and I have some big news. In the last episode with Jed Smith, I mentioned that I was moving over to the Trends with Benefits podcast to co-host that. I'm no longer doing that. I'm going to be recording from this platform, the Kyle Tierman Show. I'm learning that it is just a lot more simple and streamlined to be podcasting from a platform that I can own and operate. If you'd like to continue listening to the Trends with Benefits podcast, I encourage you to do that. It will be hosted by the lovely Sarah Russell, who you may know because she's been a guest on this show many times, but I will not be there. I will be here at the Kyle Tierman Show. And if you would like to check out more of my writing, you can go to tierman.substack.com. Just click the link in the description below. I will be putting out a Friday newsletter, just something that can bring a little bit of delight to you before you head into your weekend. And speaking of delight, I was really happy to have this podcast. I'm a big fan of this guy's work. I've been reading him for a long time, and I really encourage all of you to go out and buy his books. It will just make you 15% happier, better, and a more observant human. That is really what this guy does so elegantly. Ross Gay is the author of four books of poetry, the names of which are Bringing the Shovel Down, Against Which, Be Holding, and The Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, which was the winner of the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award and the 2016 Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. His first collection of essays, The Book of Delights, was released in 2019 and was a New York Times bestseller. His new collection of essays, Inciting Joy, will be released in October of 2022. My friends, it is a great honor to welcome to the show Ross Gay.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
All right, Ross Gay, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
I appreciate it. So the first thing that I want to talk about is a notebook that I hear you have or had, on the front of which are the words, "Pay attention, motherfucker."
Yeah.
And I want to have you talk about that notebook and those words on the front.
I love that. So that's the title. The title of the essay is nicknames, but that's in this essay from my book, The Book of Delights, which is a book of short essays that I wrote over the course of a year, every day writing about something that delighted me. One of the things that delighted me were two things, actually. One is that my friend had the nickname Boogie, which I gave to him. I was sort of delighted by that nickname that I gave him. But the other thing is that the essay sort of starts out is that with the delight that he sent me a couple of notebooks that he had printed on a letterpress. And they said, one of them said, "Pay attention," and one of them said, "Pay attention, motherfucker." I love them because he gave them to me, but I did also love them because, part of the exercise of writing for me, and maybe particularly he was sending them to me, I think in part because he knew that I was doing this. I gave myself this year-long project, this writing project, to note delights for the year, daily for the year. So it was sort of an encouragement to be paying attention. I can start there.
Nice. And also, just as far as audio goes, make sure you're speaking pretty close to the mic.
Okay. Yeah.
Awesome. Paying attention is a close cousin of meditation. Do you meditate, and has meditation had any impact on your work?
Yeah, I've sort of, I guess for, I guess I've been sort of learning about and trying to meditate probably from the time I was about, 24 or something. A friend of mine exposed me to Pema Chodron's writing. And so at that point, I kind of started to learn a little bit about meditation, and I've, over the years, I've you know, gone to the one of the Buddhist centers in town in Bloomington where I live, and I've done some of the mindfulness training and all that stuff. So I've been in that realm of practice for a while.
Have you ever done a retreat, a longer meditation retreat?
Not a longer one, but I've done, you know, like a 3-day silent retreat. I would like to do a long one for sure.
What was the 3-dayer like? What was your experience there?
It was just lovely. It was sort of, you know, the experience of not, I was with my partner, and it was a group. It was a big group, but I was just sort of the experience, which was a pleasure, but also, you know, a challenge of not saying words while in the presence of other people, and while needing to communicate a little bit too, was definitely sort of, I mean, it was interesting, it was challenging, and it was lovely, you know, but it also made the experience of coming out of that a little bit more precious in a certain kind of way, you know, like when you do get to speak. And I think probably this was expressed during the teaching too, that one of the benefits maybe of that experience is that you are a little bit more acutely aware of what you're saying, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I've done one silent meditation retreat. It was up in kind of close to the Santa Cruz Mountains in Northern California with a guy named Adi Ashanti. Have you ever heard of Adi Ashanti?
Yeah.
So he led it, and it was a 6-day silent meditation retreat. And every evening he would do a satsang. So people could come up, they could ask one question, but a lot of it was just, you know, he would be speaking every night, and then we'd do, you know, 5 or 6 silent meditations throughout the day. You know, it was, and compared to what I had done in the past, which were just like a lot of shorter, you know, 20-minute long meditations using meditation apps, it certainly took me into the next room of consciousness that I had not really experienced.
Yeah.
But there was one funny thing happened to me while on the retreat. There were these bunk beds that we were all staying in. You know, it was kind of up in the mountains with redwoods, and we would stay in these little cabins. And my bunkmate was this guy who, throughout the week, I was interacting with in minor nonverbal ways, right? Like, oh, you need to go brush your teeth. Okay, I need to go brush my teeth. Like, knock, knock, are you in the bathroom? You know, so we were sort of communicating all week without having ever spoken to each other.
Yeah.
And then when the meditation retreat ended, we all had a big lunch together, and that's when you get to talk to people. And we sat down together, and I'm like, hey, man, you know, how are you? And it turned out that he was German and didn't speak English.
Great.
And it was just the most clear example of assumptions that you make about a person.
Yeah. That's so good.
Yeah. It was a fun one. Well, speaking of words and a person who is a lover of words, do you have any favorite words right now, or any words that you've been using especially a lot these days?
Oh, good question. I've been saying the word like beloved, and this beholding, beloved, beloving, belonging. Those words have kind of been popping around my head lately. There was another, you know, someone asked me this recently, like, do you have a favorite word? And I said, no, I don't have a favorite word. But then I was reading something and I was like, oh, that could be one of my many favorite words. But now, of course, I can't remember what that word was.
What does beloved evoke for you?
There's something about, you know, this book called Beholding. It's a long poem that ostensibly sort of is a meditation on this move by the basketball player from the 80s and 90s, Dr. J. It's like a 3-second move. And this is like a 90-page book that kind of departs from meditations on that move. But that beholding, the word beholding, to look, or to regard, kind of broken apart to mean, to maybe mean something like, how do we be, you know, to be holding one another, is really moving to me. So then I started thinking about, oh, the word like belonging, and how does that kind of work? Like, you know, the word, oh, so anyway, beloved is kind of like that. Beloved, how do you be loved? Or how do we be, you know, in the act of loving, be loving? Those are really compelling questions to me. And the fact that it's kind of held, all those questions are held in a word. You know, the word loving is a moving word to me. It's a beautiful word to me. But the word beloved, you know, it's sort of like an imperative to be loving. Mm. But it also seems to have more of a question to it too, like, which I can't exactly explain, but it feels like a more of an inquisitive word than simply loving.
I like the idea of looking at a single word and thinking about all of the questions that you can ask around that word.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've never considered.
Yeah.
Is that a discipline of yours in some way, or a way to jumpstart poetry or essays, is to look at a word and ask all the potential, like look at all the potentialities of that word and all the places that it could go?
Oh, I think so. I think it's I think it's sort of like part of the one of the many sort of strategies of like getting closer to the language or defamiliarizing actually the language. You know, sometimes we use words in ways that are whatever, our familiar ways of using them. But then if you kind of do the etymology and you kind of look at the history of the word and what, you know, where the word has traveled and where it emerges from and the different connections to the words, it kind of, for me, it will often make a word way more mysterious than I had previously thought of it. So, you know, it's a pretty common thing for me. You know, I have my like big old Oxford English dictionary, huge dictionary that has all the the long histories of these words. And I do like to sometimes just kind of check them out, some of which will sometimes appear in a poem or an essay that I'm working on, but sometimes it'll just kind of inform something I'm working on.
And what does the process look like for you? Do you sit down with a notebook, and if a word catches your eye or you want to explore it more deeply, what does that writing process look like? I know that you enjoy writing at cafes quite a bit. If someone else wanted to explore a word more deeply, what would be the starter kit?
Well, it's funny, you know, because like it is that very nuts and bolts things of like looking it up. And I'm always looking, I'm always looking words up. Not always. In fact, the kind of funny thing about that Book of Delights is that I didn't look the word delight up until the whole time I was writing it, actually, that book. I didn't look the word up. I just was sort of using my kind of vernacular understanding of the word. But usually, if I'm kind of getting into a word, that's one of the first things that I'll do, just figure out, simple, you know, like probably on the internet or something. But then, yeah, I might kind of like want to look at either the actual physical, you know, Oxford English Dictionary, or Edom Online is like a really, Etymology Online is what it's short for, Edom Online. It's a really, really fun thing to like look at. You just look at like, you know, what's the etymology of the word beloved? And it'll take you, you know, far back. And then it might, it's also kind of like a rabbit hole or whatever. And it'll take you into all these other things. And I might have a kind of notebook where I'm kind of keeping track of that. Or another thing that's sort of a different way that I sometimes approach it, and I'll call it a little bit jokingly, like lyric etymology. So I'll kind of like imagine the way that words go together, and sometimes intentionally sort of, you know, pretend that they go together in ways that they don't actually go together. I have this poem called Weeping, and I sort of do this false etymology of the word weeping. That it's funny. I mean, to me, it's just like some fun poetry stuff. But at some point, some people who are like medievalists, you know, people who like write about and study medieval times, I think that means old times. They thought that this etymology, this false etymology that I did, was a sort of legitimate etymology. So I like to do that too. You know, in a way, it's sort of like the idea is like you're using the language and you're entering the language, and often you're playing with the language in order to sort of get to something that that you needed to get to, you know. So it's not that the language or the word itself is a kind of endpoint. It's that the word maybe is a way, the word and what it might evoke or encourage you to get into is actually the point, you know.
I use a system when I'm preparing for podcasts where I'll sort of think about the person. I'll write the person's name at the top of the page, and then I'll think of and write down every bad question I can think of in it's like a 15 minute time period. And most of them are just horrible.
What's a horrible question? What's an example of
a horrible question? Yeah. I mean, I actually have, I think I have someone on my first draft of yeah, getting yeah. Of yours.
Yeah.
yeah, this is fun.
Are you trying?
Well, I had one where I had one that I didn't think was great, where I was asking about, but I mean, maybe this is all right, but it had to do with marketing and how you think about marketing while writing a book. And if you think about market, but this is like, I think that was just my copywriter, like, yeah. you know, yeah, yeah. brain, like getting into like the salesiness of, yeah. Of a project, which I don't know, maybe there's something interesting there, but I didn't then include it in my, and then I, you know, I just sometimes will write down words like, or phrases like hole in the head, which I know is one of the essays in yeah. Book of Delights, but I didn't do any more thinking on how to get into that question,
yeah, yeah.
you know, or what it is around it. But I just thought, okay, well, that's interesting. You know, like you, that's for people who haven't read the essay, like that's an essay on an experiment that was done on a group of young Black people in the 1920s, where they radiated them right. to the point of where one of them ended up with a hole in his head. And it's about, I mean, what I got out of it was why Black people have a right to be suspicious.
Yeah.
And I think that that's, you know, it's an interesting subject, but I didn't really know exactly how to enter into that. So I just wrote hole in the head.
Yeah.
And then maybe it would be something that we could get to later. Right. But I do, but I just think that the power of questions and the power of just giving yourself the freedom to write bad questions yeah. can often be a really fruitful exercise. And whether or not you're doing it around the subject of a person's name or a single word, it's just remarkable how many paths that simple act of curiosity can take you down.
Yeah, that's right. And part of that I wanted to hear him is because that's an exercise that I'll do actually sometimes with students. I'll, you know, we'll write, you know, just like, you know, often very quickly, but something that could be like, you know, write the worst, you know, just write 10 terrible lines of poetry real quick, you know? And
right.
And there's something like actually to be like the way you put it, like, you know, write terrible questions, the first terrible questions, is one, often those things are actually incredibly interesting, you know, just because there's not the pressure to make them smart or to make them polished or to make them like interesting, quote unquote. And so then just stuff will sometimes fly out. But I also like, I feel like I'm constantly doing that because I am like a notebook person, and I'm always kind of taking notes on, you know, on this or that thing that I'm working on. And those notes are, they're usually just the sort of messy stuff that's not itself going to be the thing that I'm writing about, or that might not be the actual language that shows up in a poem or an essay, but it's absolutely necessary to the process. I know this now. It's absolutely necessary to the way that these poems or essays sort of get formed. So even, you know, all the little scribbling and the little notes and the questions and the little, you know, false etymologies or the little, you know, this and that, or, you know, noting what someone else has said, that's all going to be important to what will come later.
Mm. So when it comes to asking questions, just in that initial stage or process, like I've spoken with quite a few comedians, and asking them about their joke writing process, and they'll kind of talk about it as like something gets them, like there's just a slight sensitivity or annoyance around something that they can't quite describe, but they just sort of feel it. Mm. And then they may just write down that word, and then they'll go and they'll talk about it on stage and sort of work out ultimately how they feel about that idea.
Yeah.
Is it something similar for you? Like where do you feel an essay in your body first, or the idea for an essay as something like, and how would you describe that feeling that gets you to invest time in exploring the subject further?
Yeah, beautiful. It's, you know, it's like, you know, it's, I love comedy, and I feel like what you're describing is very close to what my experience is. And it's, though I wouldn't say it's, for me, it's not an annoyance usually, though sometimes it is, and sometimes it's a rage, and sometimes it's a hurt, and sometimes it's a wound, and sometimes it's a this and that and everything. But it's always also a question. So anytime I go into writing, I think anything, you know, and sometimes that might be I might not know the question yet, but I might have a feeling, and the feeling, like what you were saying, you know, for a comedian might be something like annoyance or something. The feeling for me might be sort of nebulous, that I'm not going to know quite what the question is until I get into the writing itself. But it will eventually, I know this, it will eventually sort of make itself available or present to me. But for me, it's a question. So it's always, it's always something that, you know, troubling is actually a pretty good word for it. Some kind of trouble that I'm trying to sort of, it's funny, I usually say question, but I do think trouble is part of it. And it's trouble that I'm trying to more clearly articulate or illuminate. Like I want to know what is this sort of, you know, question, disturbance, unsettledness, dis-ease or something, you know, and the process of writing an essay, you know, ostensibly about this thing, toward this thing, might either further illuminate it or might even ease to some extent that dis-ease, you know.
Do you have an example of that?
Well, a great example, and it comes back to sort of meditation stuff, is the essay. There's an essay in my new book called, the book is called Inciting Joy, and it's like 13 or 14 essays about that ask the question. And it asks the sort of premise of the book, or the big question of the book. There's two questions, actually. The first question is, what incites joy? So, and I kind of want to know, what are the practices that we do that incite joy? And I'll just say, too, like a quick shorthand definition for joy, which I'm kind of defining throughout the book, but a shorthand definition is something like the light that comes off of us when we help each other carry each other's sorrows. So what incites joy and what does joy incite? And those are sort of the they're not twins, but those are the two questions. So in this one essay, it's called Grief Suite. And in a way, it's sort of an essay about you know, masculinity, football, things like that. That's kind of where I thought it was starting. And then I realized, oh, it's an essay about grief. And one of the things that happens in that essay is I'm sort of writing at length about some sort of, you know, emotional / mental / psychic troubles that I was having, acute troubles, sometime around after my father's, throughout my sort of adulthood, but like, a certain kind of acute trouble that I was having in my 20s. And at some point I was, one of the shapes of this trouble, or this trouble sort of took a particular kind of shape after my dad died when I was about 28, 29. And my mother was overwhelmed with sorrow. She was devastated. They had been married for 35 years. He was the center of her world, truly. And I was, you know, in a way incapable of either attending to my own sorrow or getting close to my mother's sorrow. That was actually, and it felt brutal. It felt brutal, to go visit her all the time, which I did all the time. But I felt like I was, you know, it just felt brutal. And I realized at some point, and I was also like kind of losing my mind in the midst of it. I felt like I was losing my fucking mind. And while I was having those feelings, I also enrolled in a mindfulness meditation class down at Thomas Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia. And it was on like an 8-week class or something. And one day, I tell this story in the book. One week, the way the class would work is each week they'd give you like some kind of meditation technique and you would learn it in class and then you'd go do it for the week and then you'd come back and, you know, kind of talk about it and then you'd learn a new one. So this week it was like the body scan and you relax your forehead and you relax the crown of your head, you relax your forehead, you relax your cheeks and you go down and you do your body, your whole body. And so we did that for the week and came back. And then the teacher said, hey, could we just, this time, let's just go from our feet to our head instead of our head to our feet. And so we did that and it was cool. the one of the students in the class expressed that she didn't like it. You know, everyone else was like, yeah, it's fine, it's great. But one person said she didn't like it. And the teacher asked, well, what was it about? And, you know, she was kind of like, I'm not sure. And the teacher in this very like loving way that was all unfamiliar to me. This was like, I did not know the whole thing of like checking in and like, being, you know, like in a meditation class, like, you know, your people are gentle and tender with each other. And she eventually started to cry and she said, oh, I feel sad. I feel sad. And the teacher said, is it okay if we kind of talk more about this? And the woman said, yeah, it's fine. And so they were talking and crying and I realized in the midst of this that I was having the precise feeling that I had every time that I went up to be with my mother. And the feeling was something like, my chest was being crushed. And I actually realized that I actually wasn't looking at this woman who was crying. She was having a very common sorrow. You know, I can't remember what it was, but it was something about her son. I remember that. And it was not, you know, there was nothing, it was daily. And I realized, oh, you can't look at your sorrow. You can't be with sorrow, period. And then, you know, throughout this essay, I sort of like started to think about like, what is the horror of being with one's sorrow? And I sort of in the process of writing, it occurred to me that among the sorrows or among the terrors of that is that you realize that you are not alone. You are connected to everything. You know, if you're capable of being moved, if you're capable of being having your heart broken, if you're capable of being hurt, that means that you are not distinct. You are not a soul, you know, sort of creature living by itself. You know, it means you are a connected thing, which I think in a certain way of thinking can be horrifying. It can be just horrifying. And so, but it's the case, you know. So the sort of realization in the process of writing that essay was that, oh, one of my worries, one of my fears, one of my terrors, and this sort of relationship to grief, which is, I feel like, will be a lifelong sort of, you know, consideration and reconsideration and reconsideration, is that I have been terrified at the prospect of being movable, of being fundamentally connected to everything, which fundamentally I am.
When you talk about bringing words to feelings and helping that alleviate the feeling even for you, why do you think that happens? I mean, a lot of what you do actually could be boiled down to that offering for people, right? They have a feeling that they can't quite articulate, and then you articulate it in a certain way in a poem or essay mm-hmm. that you know, lightens the backpack a little bit. Do you have any thoughts about why? I know this is just a really big question, but like why that is, that when we can articulate things, it frees us in a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, I have some ideas. I mean, one is that it feels like I've had the experience plenty of times where I have a feeling, but I don't know that I might not even quite know that I have a feeling that could be articulated in a certain kind of way. And then I read something, and that something is sort of like, oh, that was this inarticulable thing that I didn't even realize was sort of troubling me, or that was, that, like you said, it was sort of making my backpack extra heavy. So I do feel like there is some way that experiences, which are often common, you know, so experiences that we have in common that are elsewhere outside of us articulated, help for us understand. I mean, first of all, it makes us know that we're not alone, which is crucial. Like really crucial. I feel like so much of our experience is like all kinds of experiences is that we think we're the only ones having the experience. And often, like, sort of just again talking about like sort of emotional strife, anguish, you know, etc. We often sort of walk around, you know, full of shame because we think we're the only ones that, you know, have had this, you know, experience or this trouble. But I think there's also that real sort of, that real other thing, which is that sometimes someone will articulate a thing that you did not yet even know was sort of inside of yourself waiting to be articulated, you know? Like, yeah. And there's a poem by the poet Amiri Baraka, and there's a way, it's called An Agony As Now. And it's, in a way, it's like the first thing that I read that made me think, oh, I want to be a writer. And it was a poem I read in my second year of college. And I was just like, you know, not doing well. I was probably depressed, at least. I was like, you know, just like, you know, I was a football player and it wasn't going good. And I hated school. And I had never been around people with money like this. And it was just, everything was difficult in my, you know, it was just having a little bit of a hard time. And I had no sort of language for it besides, this sucks, you know? And I read this poem, and this poem is sort of just this incredibly beautiful, complex sort of meditation on alienation, at least. And that was one of the things that I was feeling profoundly. I think one of the first lines of the poem, it might start, I'm inside of someone who hates me. And oof. Yeah, and I just had not, and if we pulled up the poem now, it's like a poem that I will never have a full grasp on until I die. It's that kind of rich of a poem, but there are these moments inside of the poem that are just so true is actually the word. And that's what it felt like when I was 19 and I needed something to articulate for me with what I did not yet know how to articulate. And I didn't even yet know necessarily how to feel. And that, I think that maybe feels really important.
Yeah. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, man. I didn't grow up a writer. And I had a chance when I was in my early 20s to write an article for a local surf magazine in Santa Cruz. And it was called "The End of the Ride: Is Pro Surfing a Dead End Career?" I grew up wanting to be a pro surfer, and a lot of my friends were pro surfers. And I was noticing that there were a lot of people in town who chose that path and then ended up, 35 years old with no job experience, and a lot of them were turning to drugs and a resentful last 2/3 of their life. And no one was really talking about it. Pro surfing is this incredibly glamorized thing, right? And you get a lot of social status in certain circles for being like, oh yeah, there's Ross Gay, he's the big wave surfer, right? And it can feel really good. But I was noticing this, and I was also very much on the inside of it. And I wrote that article. And it was one of the scariest things I've ever done. The magazine put it in very big print there. And my name was right there up front. And it was uncomfortable, because I was at the center of this kind of world. And I had a number of people come up to me afterwards, moms of kids who were surfers and that kind of thing, and they just said thank you in a way that I hadn't really heard anyone say around anything I had ever done. Yeah. Like just that tone, like, oh, of thank you for saying that and for doing it. And it was a feeling that I had not been in or experienced. Like I said before, doing a meditation retreat, there was just a room that I opened in the palace of consciousness that I was just like, oh, I didn't know this was there. Mm-hmm. And I got that from writing that. And it was all over for me, after that. So I very much know what you mean. The power of articulating a thought, is just one of the best in the world.
Yeah. And it's like one of these sort of, I can't remember what I wrote it, but I just wrote the phrase, the circuits of gratitude. And it feels like when you do something like that, you offer it, and you offer it at some sort of, like you said, like some risk, it feels dangerous in a certain kind of way, but it's a kind of offering. And then the reply is like gratitude, but your offering itself was a kind of evidence of a kind of gratitude, like you were, you weren't doing it, presumably to get rich. or to make all your friends.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like you were sort of doing it as a kind of like, some understanding inside of yourself that you wanted to sort of offer something, probably because you had been offered something else. Not like it's necessarily like one-to-one or anything like that, but it just feels like one of these beautiful things where when you get to write something that like the Baraka poem for me, completely sort of really helps me, or if I get to do that for someone else, it's like being plugged into a kind of circuit of gratitude. It feels like the offering then is actually it's just like a different thing. It's like, oh yeah, I write out of gratitude, and these poems and these essays are ideally, they're the evidence of a kind of gratitude.
Was there a day or a moment when you decided that you were a writer? Was there any kind of interaction where you said, I'm a writer now, or a thought where that switch flipped for you?
You know, I I do kind of think it was reading those poems by Baraka. Like I do, because I wasn't a reader much when I was a kid, and I don't know, you know, who knows what would have happened, but I don't know if I would have been a big reader, had I not been introduced to his poems. Maybe I would have. I was meeting other people who would have probably introduced me to cool stuff that I would have been taken by, but I do feel like it was reading those poems that made me think, oh, I want to do this. I want to, again, an expression of gratitude, actually. I want to do the thing that Baraka did for me. You know, I want to, not that I could perfectly articulate what that was at that time, and probably still can't, but I did have the feeling of like being moved. And I did like the idea of also offering that to other people.
So you mentioned not reading a lot growing up, which I think is interesting because, like, I feel a kinship with you because I too was not, I wasn't a big reader. I was more of an athlete, like, but spent a lot of time outside. Yeah. And writing, comparatively to a lot of other people, came to me late in life. And I feel a certain sense of, you know, I've had some really great editors in my life who have helped teach me the craft, but I still feel a bit of a willingness to break rules that traditional writers tend not to. Yeah. And I see that a lot in your writing. And I've read The Book of Delights many times because I find that it's a really good reminder for me when I start to just get into a rhythm of writing in a certain way too often that is too simple, too direct, too like, this is the way you do it. I can open that book and, I mean, you put some commas in places where they really shouldn't be. Really, they have no business being there, man. Right. But it, it forces me to slow down. You know, it almost feels like when I'm reading your writing, I'm trying to sprint ahead, and then something sort of like pulls me back. You know, every once in a while, there's like this big, you know, it's like those people who are like attached to the giant rubber bands, and they're sprinting forward as fast as they can. And then a comma or, you know, parentheses hits, and it kind of like, whoop, like pulls me back and forces me to study what it is you're actually saying. Right. Do you have any sense of that where you're like, I'm going, this is what I can do, like, you know, and I'm going to continue to write in a way that is, very different.
You know, it's funny, one of the things I was going to say is that, and this is something that I didn't know when I started reading and was so moved by the writers that I was moved by at the beginning, is that probably they were also making work that was profoundly changing to them. And so one of the things that my writing practice is about is, you know, like I said, sort of writing from questions, or, you know, say writing from questions. And so that the process of writing is always a process of tangling with a question, and ideally either shedding light on that question or sometimes approaching an answer to that question, which then will probably turn into many other questions. But so, which is also to say that the process of writing is not one of knowledge, it's one of curiosity. And I feel like, one of curiosity and inquiry. And I feel like one of the things that feels useful to me as a writer is, because we do often get very familiar in the ways that we think, and writing is an expression of thinking, there's ways that, and because we get familiar in that, and my objective is not to sort of reside in what is familiar. My objective is to actually kind of defamiliarize, to learn something else, you know, to kind of have a transformation in the process of writing. so that I need to be sort of conscientiously, or I like to be conscientiously trying to disrupt what I'm good at, you know? So if I know how to write, you know, a very clear sentence, or if I know how to write whatever it is, I'm interested in figuring out ways where I can sort of trouble that, where I can make myself have to think in ways that I wouldn't necessarily think. The very simplest sort of expression of that is like, you know, a lot of writing is sort of how we talk. You know, we talk in sort of familiar ways, something you might call that cliche way, cliche language. And cliches are just sort of language that's become very familiar. It's a kind of, it becomes sort of empty of a lot of meaning, but it's, you know, it's useful. It's what we do. But if our writing gets sort of filled with cliche, or if, and just to take it a step further, if our writing just becomes sort of patterned or familiar in a certain kind of way, it seems less likely that my objective anyway, which is to unknow myself, you know, in the process of getting to better acquaint myself with myself, you know, unknow myself to get more closer to myself, actually. It seems more difficult to do, you know? So what are the ways that I can kind of, you know, defamiliarize myself in my writing, you know? There's the other thing that I think is powerful about that. And I wonder if you feel this a little bit, having come a little bit right later to writing and stuff. There's a really strong impulse for a lot of people, especially people who are like, you know, good at shit, maybe good at school, stuff like that, to just be good. Just be good at everything. And, you know, that's cool. But to me, like writing, you know, thinking, being that is simply good, is, I'm often suspicious of that. You know, I'm probably not all that interested in it, but I distrust the impulse to be simply good in myself. I'll say it like that, I should say.
Yeah, I think that being good at stuff is a really close cousin of being boring.
totally.
And I've noticed this, you know, I think that probably the simplest way to get famous is to specialize in one subject and be the expert on that one subject and talk about it ad nauseum, and then speak about it and write a book about it and be on podcasts and have your sound bites. It's a very direct path to becoming well known. I've had a number of those people on the podcast, but I always just wonder, how fucking bored are you of saying this stuff? And I've become very suspicious of that in my own life, and have made a very concerted effort to have the things that I get good at continuously be interesting to me.
Exactly. And it's like, it's how do you, because a little bit, so I got a book called Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude. I have a book of delights, and then this Inciting Joy book. And then, you know, so to some extent, like, I get to be in this experience of like, well, people are probably going to some extent want to sort of approach me. You know, it's just like sort of how it is. Like, some people are going to want to approach me as like a kind of, you know, this guy knows everything there is to know about delights.
Yeah, he's the delight expert.
He's a delight guy. And you know, that's the last fucking thing in the world I want to be, actually. You know, like, I'm so excited to talk with people about delight and joy and wonder and, you know, gratitude in really complex ways. And in ways that I hope I never am like at all sort of professorial or like professing a kind of finalized understanding of any of this shit. Like, cause it's, you know, it's just like, one, I think it's just like probably be bullshit, but also so, like you said, boring, you know, just so boring. I'm just so not interested in it. Like, if my understanding isn't like sort of being regularly like troubled a little bit, then I'm kind of not interested in it, I think.
I've heard I've heard you speak of writing as a discipline, and you know, you talk about being being a football player and having, I'm guessing that there was a lot of just practice, like, okay, I'm just going to show up today because there's practice. And athletes just get that. If you want to get good at something athletically, you just show up to practice and you do it. I think that people who are entering into the arts presume that they should wait for inspiration to start. What does a writing session look like for you? Is there a time of day that you'll tend to do it? And I was hoping that you could just speak a bit more about the discipline of it. Because I think it's a common, common misnomer.
You know, I have sort of actually, like, for most of my life, I've had kind of periods of like intense writing where I'd be writing all the time, and then periods of sort of like a quieter time. When I wrote this Book of Delights, which is a daily practice, where every essay, I just gave myself the task of writing an essay daily, but quickly, a half hour an essay. And actually, it kind of connects back to your, you know, write 15 terrible questions first or whatever, because the idea for writing in a quick amount of time was to remove the imperative to be good. You know, 30 minutes, I'm not going to make anything good in 30 minutes. Like, get that out of the way. Maybe you'll make something interesting, though. So I think it was the case. That was like 2016 that I wrote that book, 2016, 2017. And I kind of got into maybe into a habit of a daily thing, you know. And it's like I said, like a 30 minute kind of daily thing, which I just wrote another one of those books. So I have been in that for the last year. But I do feel like that entering a kind of dailiness of the thing, like a dailiness where I'm actually putting my pen on the paper, has kind of informed what I do. I mean, we might have to talk in 10 years to see actually what it's, if I can sort of see like what it's really done. But that's all to say that, like, for, you know, the last year, I've been like every day sitting down for a half hour at least to work on something. And the other thing is that, at this point, I've come to understand that when I'm, you know, when I'm reading, I'm probably working on essays or poems. When I'm having this conversation with you, I'm probably working on essays or poems. When I go out and swing kettlebells in a little bit, you know, it might not be explicit, but that might be a little bit more, more of a reach. But, you know, it might be the case that I'm also kind of working on essays and poems. When I take a walk and sort of observe the way that the leaves are changing colors, or look at the trees around here, I'm kind of working on essays and poems. So in a certain kind of way, that's a long way of saying that in addition to like the sitting down and writing, which is crucial, I think it's also, for me, it's been very important to sort of expand my notion of what a discipline or a practice, I like to say, is. So if I have a really loving conversation with anyone, that to me constitutes part of the practice, you know, like I'm learning how to write better essays by asking questions, you know, by by listening, you know.
Do you keep a notebook with you when you're going around the day if there is an observation that you want to note later?
Yeah, I always carry notebooks. I'm like a notebook freak. I love them. I love them, and I, you know, it's ridiculous how much I love notebooks. But I also, because I, you know, I'm like, I guess I'm like half magic and half not magic. But I will. this is a little bit funny to say, but I'll say it because it's true. I like will. You know, if I'm in a place that has a bunch of notebooks, like I'll go around and like rub all the paper on the notebooks. And really what I'm trying to look for a feeling like a toothiness to the paper. And that toothiness has to do with the kind of pens that I like to use. And there's something about, there really is, there's something about, oh, the combination between this pen and this paper is going to make something really good happen, you know?
So you're just like, you're just scribbling a little bit in all of these new notebooks.
I'm like, put them back.
Yeah. I did make a note of a line that you have in one of your books by a woman named Susan Santong, I believe. Maybe I'm pronouncing that wrong, but she said that any technology that slows us down in our writing rather than speed it up is something that we ought to use.
Yeah, Susan Sontag. Mm. Yep.
So are you pretty much always writing in notebooks?
Always. Yeah, I always have one. The one that I have in my pocket right now, it's very, it's beautiful. It was handmade by someone who I met up in Northfield, Minnesota. She put it in the mail, sent it to me, and it has very good texture paper. It has like a little kind of painting on the front of it. It's hand bound. It's doing really good for me.
Good relationship.
It's nutty. I'm like, there's so many notebooks around. There's like, you know, a handful of things that I get a little bit kooky about, like that, and notebooks is one of them.
Do you keep a notebook next to your bed when you dream? I've read some of your stuff where you'll evoke a dream that you had a while back. Mm-hmm. Is that also a practice of yours?
I don't usually just keep I mean, it might just be the case that I empty my pockets and my notebooks there, but I don't usually write my my dreams in my notebooks right away. But I talk about my dreams to whoever will listen right away. So,
yeah. Well, that's always the, you know, if you're in a relationship, usually the first question you get when you wake is, "How did you sleep?" Which is really the question of, are you going to be nice today?
Yeah.
Maybe the follow up is, what have you been dreaming about?
Yeah, totally. Exactly. I love to hear people's dreams, and I appreciate it when people love to hear, or at least can tolerate mine.
Yeah. Nice, man. Well, hey, I'll let you go soon, but you know, I wanted to let you know how I came across your writing. I was a couple of years ago getting out of a very long-term relationship, one that I was in for most of my 20s, and we broke up right before COVID hit. Mm-hmm. And I matched with got on the dating apps, you know, a few weeks after, and I matched with a girl. Her name was Arielle, and we matched on Hinge, and we went out on a date, and it ended up not being a romantic thing, but it was just a new friendship, which, you know, it's always nice when that happens, right? When you're like, oh, sweet, and a new friend, and it really was just what I needed at the time.
Yeah.
Shortly after I met her and we became friends, I decided that I was going to spend a good chunk of my savings and buy this old 1997 Ford RV that had the word Starflight on the front. So her name is Starflight, and was embarked on this 4-month trip across Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, made a lot of new friends on that journey, spent a lot of time alone, a lot of time writing. But before I left, this girl gave me your book, The Book of Delights.
Wow.
And I had it with me for this big journey, which I often say was like my eat, pray, love journey. But it meant a huge amount to me at that time in my life, and was a continuous reminder to keep that in my mind during a time of sorrow. And since then I've gifted your book to more people than I can count. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. It's had a really tremendous impact in my life.
Well, thank you for telling me, and thank your friend for sharing it too.
Yeah, yeah. Her name's Ariel. You can thank her.
Yeah, thanks, Ariel.
Yeah. But yeah, man, this was just such a joy to be able to chat with you. And if you ever make it out to Los Angeles, we'd love to have you come speak at Mudwater. Yeah, and just keep writing, man.
Thank you. Same to you. Yeah, this is a really, really beautiful conversation. I'm grateful for it.
Thank you. And is there a way, what's the best place for people to check out your work? And please plug your latest book.
Yeah. I have a book coming out October 25th, actually. So maybe by the time this is up, that'll be out. October 25th. It's called Inciting Joy. And then I have a website. It's rossgay.net. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. that's as much as I got.
Like a true writer. I once heard someone say, if a writer's Instagram is too good, I become suspicious.
Yeah, my Instagram's in my pocket. It's my notebook. Yeah.
Well, Ross, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good one. Good to talk to you.
That's our show. If you're not sick of me yet and you want a little more, you can head over to tierman.substack.com and check out my Friday newsletter. Just a little bit of delight to put a grin on your face before you head into the weekend, or you can just click the link in the description below this podcast. This show, as well as all of my writing, is supported by people like you. So if you want to make a donation on my Substack, I'd be grateful. If you're not in that position, don't worry. Just keep enjoying sharing it and go be a good person. If you'd like to send in a voice memo to be played at the beginning of this podcast, just bust out your phone, record about a minute of audio. Let me know who you are, where you're listening from, and if you can keep it under 90 seconds, I'd love to play it on the show. Just email that to info@kyle.surf. That email is also in the description below this podcast. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.